On this show, I'm going to talk about why I left Japan and the reverse culture shock that I experienced in Canada, which caused me to move back to Japan and start a travel business in probably the worst possible time in recent history. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Tokyo. Why did I say welcome back? It's been 2 years since I've done a show, so welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. On this show, I thought I would talk about why I left Japan and why I moved back to Japan and what am I doing here and why am I recording this show again? What happened to the podcast? Because I think last time I mentioned it, I think I was going to sell it. I actually did sell it, so why am I back and what's going on? So anyways, I left Japan in 2018, moved to Canada for a number of reasons. One of which was that by 2018, I had been outside of Canada. I've been living outside of Canada for over 11 years. I left in, I think, early 2007. And I lived in Germany, I lived in Thailand, and I lived in Japan. And while I really enjoyed living as an expat in these foreign countries, by this time, I kind of was starting to feel a little bit like I wouldn't mind living in an English-speaking country again. Yeah, I would say that for an expat, a lot of the daily frustrations that you might encounter, a huge, probably 89% of that comes down to language. I think a small percentage of it is cultural, and maybe just not knowing what's going on, but a lot of that is language. And so, and of course you're thinking like, well, you could easily fix that just by learning the language. I find for me that I really suck at learning languages, because I find for me that if I attempt to do something, I'm one of those people who like, if I want to do something, I will do it 100%, like in a very short period of time. So I will like, for example, when I went back to Canada, I took up mountain biking. And, you know, I bought a mountain bike. I started riding every single day. I read everything I could on mountain biking, watched tons of mountain bike videos, created my own mountain bike website so I could track my progress. Started recording my own videos, hired a coach, started running so I could improve my fitness. Like all of this I did in a very short period of time. And so I felt like if you go watch my videos, I think you'll see that I improved really quickly in a short period of time because I dumped all my energy into it. So for me, I find that if I cannot get pretty good in a very short period of time, I get bored very quickly. So I find with languages, that's for me, it's kind of the case. I'm super jealous of these polyglots who seem to like love learning languages and can pick up like 8 languages all at once or something like that. But for me, it's really been a struggle because I don't seem to like progress as quickly as I would like, and therefore I lose interest. You know, Japanese is really hard because you have hiragana, katakana. Hiragana, katakana actually wasn't that hard because that's easy to memorize. But then the kanji and the grammar structure, the grammar is like completely ass backwards to English. So it's confusing. Trying to memorize like 1,000 kanji, forget about it. I can't even remember my phone number anymore, let alone 1,000 kanji, you know. So that was always fun. When I lived in Thailand, actually, the funny thing is, I think I picked up more Thai than I did Japanese, which is strange because I used to speak Japanese fluently when I was a kid. But I think for me also too, it has to be a fun factor in it. Like, I don't find Japanese a very pleasant language to listen to or speak, whereas I find Thai more fun to speak and more fun to listen to, you know? But the problem with Thai that I found was Thai is a tonal language. And what that means is the tone changes the meaning of the word. So you have 5 tones in the Thai language, and depending on the tone, it changes the meaning of the word. And for Thais, they can hear the tonal difference like no problem, you know, super easy for them. But for foreigners, it's really hard for us to hear the difference. So you might be asking a Thai person like something and you think you're speaking Thai, but you're actually asking them the complete opposite. For example, this is the Thai word for close, like nearby, something is close to you.
Lai.
And this is the Thai word for something that is far away from you.
Lai.
Can you hear the difference? Like, that's Google Translate. That's a pretty good good pronunciation, right? But imagine that, like, conversation with someone and it's super noisy, Bangkok or whatever. Like, imagine if you ask a Thai person, like, hey, is the bank close or far away? And you're like, they can give you an answer that's completely opposite, just depending on the tone. If you don't hear that tone right, you're like, oh, is it clear? It's like, what's that movie with Sacha Baron Cohen when he changed all the words to Aladdin? And that guy in the doctor's office, he's like, HIV Aladdin. He doesn't know if he's positive or negative. That's the same with Thai, like the word near and far. It's like, is it near? Is it far? I don't know. So, yeah, it turns out that I suck at learning languages. And so I kind of been feeling for the last few years that I wouldn't mind moving back to an English-speaking country just to make things a little bit easier. Overall, I don't find it that difficult to live in Japan, even though I don't speak Japanese. This is surprising for a lot of people. It just would eliminate any kind of hassle or barrier or anything like that if I lived in an English-speaking country. So there's a combination of that. And also, as I mentioned before, is like, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast numerous times, but I really don't work well in a Japanese work environment. I don't like how the Japanese work. It just is completely the opposite of how I work. And so it was kind of those things that made me decide to want to move back to Japan. And the thing that's interesting is that, you know, I think for someone else, maybe you work the way that the Japanese work, maybe you kind of fit into that groove a little bit better, so you won't have a problem. But what I found for me is that I am very, obviously, because, you know, I'm very goal driven. I'm an INTJ. I'm kind of anal in a way that I kind of plot things, and I'm very success oriented. So I like seeing results. I hate inefficiency, and I hate unproductivity. Is that word? Lack of productivity. And so those of you who are living in Japan, you're probably nodding your head right now because you're like, what the hell are you doing in Japan then? Because let's face it, productivity in Japan do not go hand in hand. And what I found is that working in various Japanese companies is that the Japanese are not really focused on the end result. They're not goal oriented. They're process oriented. So they don't really care about the end result, whether it's successful or not. They care about how is the process and did everybody agree on the process? And this really bothered me because, you know, in the work that I do, I work as a digital marketing consultant. So I would be hired to come into companies to achieve a certain result. They would say, okay, we want to promote this product online to foreigners. And we're Japanese and we don't know anything about computers, internet, marketing, foreigners. So you do it. And I'm like, okay, this is what we're going to do. And then my idea would always, always, always get modified by the Japanese to make it more Japanese-y. And then the end result would be less effective than my original proposal. And you might be thinking, okay, well, this might be common in a lot of companies that, you know, everything, you can't always, you know, get, you know, 100%. Sure, that's fine. But what the problem that I found was that the modifications that would happen would not be necessarily to make the product or the end result better. Like, I'm happy to admit if someone modifies my original proposal, but it makes the end result better. If they point out something I missed or I was wrong and they have a better suggestion, and then I see that the end result is better, I'm like, fantastic. Yeah, let's do that. But inevitably, what would happen is they would want to modify the campaign or the or whatever we're working on, not because they were thinking about what the end result was, because whatever they didn't like it because it wasn't the Japanese way that they would normally do business this way. And my, of course, the first response is, well, isn't that why you hired me? but they would want to kind of make sure that everyone is all agreement and harmony. I remember like many times, like they would, you know, I would ask someone to create a video or write an article or, you know, make a presentation or whatever, you know, they would ask me to review it. And I would look at it, and the quality was just subpar. You know, it's like just below average. And so I would mention this to them and say, hey, well, you know, this isn't very good. Why are we doing it this way? And instead of them coming back to me with like, okay, well, how can we fix it? Or how should we change it? Or, you know, can you work with Sato to improve it? Or anything like that. Like, that wouldn't be the response. The response always was try to make an excuse as to why I should agree with what they're proposing. So they'd be like, well, you know, Sato spent all night working on this. Or, well, you know, we had a tight deadline to get this done. Or something like that. And it's like, that doesn't change the fact that this is garbage. You know, like, who cares if he spent all night working on it? He should have checked with me before he even started. So, but what, see, like I said, though, is what they're looking for is for you to say, they say, hey, here's a presentation Sato spent all night working on. And what they want you to say is, yes, Sato spent all night working on this presentation. And then they're like, great. Then they go to the next manager. Hey, look, Sato spent all night working on this presentation. And he's like, yes, he did. And then they release it to the public. And that's kind of their mindset. And then if I say, hey, well, this is garbage. It's not going to work. Then they're like, well, yeah, but, you know, Sato's been with this company a long time. And like, it's like, so what? Who cares? So these are some of the frustrations I had working in Japanese companies. Combine that was actually the biggest reason why I wanted to leave Japan, is I realized, like, working for various companies, that they're all the same. I thought it was just one or two at first, but then when I started working with doing freelance work for a variety of companies, I realized these guys are all the same, no matter the size of the company, big or small, it's all the same. So combine that with a desire to kind of get back to an English-speaking environment and to also get out of living in a city for a while. I'd been living in, I was living in Bangkok, and then I was living in Tokyo, and obviously these are two like big busy cities. And I actually started to kind of miss a little bit my time in Germany, because before Japan and Thailand, I was living in Germany. I was living in the city of Munich. And Munich is absolutely gorgeous. You know, the funny thing is, I don't know why I didn't think this. I had like almost no picture in my head of what Germany was like before I went to Germany the first time. In my head, I just kind of pictured those beer halls with large people drinking large things of beer. That's about it. I never had any kind of thought or anything about like what the geography of Germany was like. I don't know why. It just never popped into my head. And then I remember when I was living in Germany, at Munich, I would drive my car around the area there, and I'm like, holy crap, is this area ever nice? Like, they have these like valleys and like the little village at the bottom with the little church and all that. It's like what you see in a postcard. I remember I went to Austria once. I went to Salzburg in Austria, and I was driving around, went to the salt mine, and oh my God, like the houses there, I don't know if I can describe it well enough on a podcast, but do you know those houses, the kind of chalet looking houses, and they've got the window shutters on the outside of the window with the little flower box underneath the window? I hope I'm describing it accurately, but I mean, you kind of see that in like the Sound of Music movie. I saw those houses everywhere. I was like, oh my God, these are real. It's like, it looks like Sound of Music. Like, if that Von Trapp family opened the door, came out, and started singing, I totally would not be surprised at all. I'd be like, yep, that's exactly what I would expect to happen here in Austria. And then Switzerland. I remember I went to Switzerland, and then I was staying at this just fantastic Airbnb in Switzerland. And in the morning, this guy was walking his cows down the road, and they all had the bells around their necks, so they're all like clanging away. And I'm just like, wow, yeah, that's kind of what I thought Switzerland would look like. These dairy cows, I guess they're dairy cows, I don't know what they are, but the cows with the bells and all that. It's just absolutely gorgeous. So anyways, so I'm kind of starting to think like, you know what? I'm a little bit tired of living in the city. There's not really much you can do in the city, in Tokyo and Bangkok. That's not obviously city related. So I kind of wanted to like get out of the city, spend more time in nature, move to a smaller town, and get back to an English-speaking environment, and preferably work with people who are a little bit more entrepreneur-minded, actually. That's kind of what my goal was. So I left Japan in 2018. I moved back to Canada, and I moved to this small city called Victoria on the west coast. It's on an island off the coast of Vancouver. Population about 300,000 people. And initially, when I first moved there, I loved it. The city of Victoria is the whole island, actually, of Vancouver Island is absolutely gorgeous. I was going to say it's one of the best looking places in Canada, but I don't know if that's actually true because there are some really gorgeous spots in Canada, but it is truly stunning. They have this natural old growth rainforest throughout the island. These huge trees are like 10, 15, 20 feet in diameter. Absolutely massive. You're right on the ocean, the Pacific Ocean there. You go down the ocean, you can see whales, going up and down. I guess they go to Alaska or wherever they're going. And the interesting thing is in the area that I settled into Victoria, it's an area, called Rockland, and it's kind of an older area. And, there's like deer like walking around the neighborhood. Not as many as like in Nara, that deer park in Lower Japan, but like, you'll see these deer, maybe about a half a dozen deer or so, just kind of wandering around the neighborhood. And I just thought it was so great. I remember the first time I saw one, I was out running really early in the morning, and I was running through this like nature trail, and this deer like was running like towards me on the trail, and it kind of freaked me out because it was so big. I thought it was a big dog. I was like, holy shit, that's a big dog. And then this deer walked right by. I was like, cool, deer. So I love living in that area. You see like rabbits, you see bald eagles, you see deer. Like, it just felt really great to be able to kind of live in an area that felt very close to nature as well. Because here in Tokyo, I don't see any wildlife at all. So initially, I liked the geography of Victoria a lot. I liked living there. Going running along the ocean every morning was fantastic. Couple things that occurred in terms of reverse culture shock that kind of surprised me. One was, ironically, the English. So I moved back to Canada because I wanted to get out of it. I wanted to get into an English-speaking environment. And the funny thing is, It actually was too overwhelming when I first initially moved back, because when I live overseas in a non-English speaking country, since I can't understand anything that's going on around me, I just tune it all out. I don't hear the people's conversations beside me. I don't hear the announcements, you know, the advertisements over the radio. You go into a shop and they're blasting some advertisements and all that. I don't hear any of that stuff. It just is all white noise, background noise. I don't hear any of it. That's why, like, I'm sure other gaijins will probably agree. Like, if you're on a train, and the train can be kind of busy or noisy, and you can hear English, like, way on the other side of the train, and your brain will, like, immediately pick it up. You know, they can be, like, 20, 30 feet away, and you're like, oh, is that English? And it just, like, cuts through all the Japanese, because you're not paying attention to it. So, when I went back to Victoria, suddenly, I was overwhelmed by all this English. The radio, the TV, the music, and more than that, it was like all the people around me just talking away. And I almost at one point wanted to like tell him, like, can you guys shut the fuck up for a bit? Because you're really noisy. Because like, I remember like I'd be sitting in a Tim Hortons donut place, and like the people behind me having some mundane conversation about like something that I'm not interested in. And then the people on the beside of me having conversation. And I'm like, God, I cannot not hear this. And so that was actually a big shock to me. I didn't expect that English to feel so noisy when I went back to Canada. And then speaking of mundane, the other thing that kind of surprised me a little bit was how hard it was to talk to people there about my experiences and kind of what's going on, so to speak. Because the city I moved back to, I used to go to high school here. So I ran into some old high school friends, people that I'd known. And of course, they always want to meet up and say, hey, how's it going? You know, we haven't seen each other, let's get together. And it was hard for me to convey my experiences that I've had in the last 10 years without sounding like I was bragging. Now, I wasn't trying to brag. It wasn't like I was like, yeah, man, I did this, I did this, I did this. I didn't think I was trying to brag, but when they asked me like, you know, how was your experience in Europe or how was your experience in Thailand or whatever? I have had some pretty interesting experiences in the last 10 years. I mean, Thailand, I was shot at by the Thai military, you know, for one. And so I've had some really unique experiences. So when they asked me, like, you know, what was your favorite experience in Asia or Europe or whatever, I just tell them, right? So, but the thing is, I think it comes across as bragging, which is not my intention. And what I found was it's really hard for them to relate to what you're saying. Because I asked them, so what have you been up to? And they're like, well, I put a new deck out back and we changed our cable subscription. So we have, you know, the new ESPN channel. It's like a lot of these people haven't changed very much in their life at all in the last 20, 30 years since they got out of high school. Like some of the people I met, I mean, honestly had almost the same job they did when they got out of high school. Like one dude I met, he's had literally two jobs since high school. He was working at this gymnastics thing after high school, and he worked there for years, and then he like worked as a carpenter. I was like, wow, good for you for finding something you like for that long, you know, like, but it was really hard for me to relate to kind of the day-to-day of these people's lives, because their day-to-day was so different, not even day-to-day, like year-to-year was so different than what I had gone through. I think it was hard for them to relate to me as well, so I found that it was difficult to actually kind of talk with these people, because I knew that they didn't really want to hear what I had to say. If I go to a party or something and someone says, oh man, you lived in Japan, was that, you know, tell me what that was like. I know what they want to hear. They don't want to hear my actual real life story. What they want to hear is a reinforcement of the story that they have in their head, that Japan is all cool, futuristic, and anime everywhere and all that kind of stuff. That's what they want me to tell them. So they actually don't want to hear the reality of what my life was like there. So I actually found that kind of surprising. Those are a couple of the culture shock things that I encountered. And the other thing too, actually, in terms of work, I was really surprised that the city that I moved to, maybe different, I think, in a larger city, but the city I moved to is pretty small. It's 300,000 people. It's kind of known as a retirement community in Canada. People joke that it's the Florida of Canada because it has the mildest climate in all of Canada. And so a lot of older people retire there. The winter is not that bad. It barely gets any snow. So it's a really nice, and the summer doesn't get hot, very hot. So it's really nice and mild all year round. So a lot of people retire. So it's kind of a retirement community. But I was really surprised actually at how many people I met who had kind of a really, outdated is the word, or just a lack of understanding about computers and technology. Like kind of the same thing I experienced in Japan. I was surprised to see that over there as well, because, you know, I understand why it happened in Japan, because in Japan, they never really had that PC revolution that we had in the early 90s. Japanese homes are so tiny that most people never bought a big PC. Most Japanese people's first internet-connected device was actually their phone. Not even a smartphone, these old Japanese flip phones that used to connect to like the local their telecommunications network. Like, remember when AOL was around and AOL, like AOL World or whatever it was called? It was something like that, like an internet service is what the Japanese people's first internet was. And then smartphones came along. So Japan never really developed any kind of like big PC culture. And that's why they're kind of clueless when it comes to using computers, because they just never really use computers for that particular purpose. They think computers are used for spreadsheets and stuff like that. But in Canada, that was, you know, everyone had a computer, right? So I kind of, for years, I mean, I thought that everybody would have an understanding of how to use a computer, how to use internet, just as easily as they can turn on their TV. That's what my thought. So I was really surprised when I went there and started to work with some clients over there, how how limited their understanding was. And even more surprising to me was some of the businesses that I did talk to, like some of these businesses that were doing the same type of work that I was doing, like digital marketing, SEO, things like that. They were really limited in their understanding of the service that they were actually trying to sell their customers. This really surprised me a lot because I thought, like, what? How, you know, this has been around for a long time in North America. How could you be so out of date? So I have a feeling it could just be that small town mentality that exists there in that one particular town. I think if I went to a bigger city, like maybe Vancouver or Toronto, that wouldn't be the case, but just kind of a small town. And the other thing I actually noticed too, you know, speaking of small town mentalities, I noticed that a lot of the businesses there, they kind of almost didn't like the internet. They had this kind of hostility towards the internet. And what I realized is that in a small town, you know, you got these business owners, small business owners, who their business hasn't changed much in 20 years or so. You know, they're selling potatoes or selling stamps or whatever they're selling, shoes or whatever. And for years and years and years, they just had a steady flow of customers. And a small town, a population of only 300,000, you're never going to become that wealthy, right? It's basically a job that you own. So you just kind of go to work every day, you do your little business, and you go home. And you're very comfortable life that way. But then the internet came along, and suddenly your customers could buy that same thing online. And so you started to lose your customer base. And what I found was a lot of these guys, a lot of these business owners, they didn't try to adapt their business or upgrade or improve their service or anything to counter the convenience of shopping online. They're just really hostile about it. They're like, I hate Amazon and all this kind of stuff. And they would, the most that they would do is put a sticker in their window that said, like, shop local. And like, what's that going to do? Your service is still garbage. Your shop looks like it's 30 years old. Like, you gotta do something to counteract people wanting to shop online. Otherwise, of course, they're going to shop online. So I was really shocked at the kind of the Inaka mentality that existed in the city of Victoria. Inaka is a Japanese word which means countryside, but it has like a deeper meaning when you apply it to like kind of people's mentality. I don't know how to explain it very well. It's just Inaka is like the word. In Thai, it's banor, something like that. I was really shocked at that. So there wasn't a lot of work opportunities for me in Victoria, especially Victoria is, like I said, is a government town. So most of the jobs in Victoria are government. Then the second largest employer is probably the military because there's a big Navy base there because it's on the West Coast. And then after that would be tourism. But really, the biggest employer is government. And let's face it, as someone who's been like an entrepreneur for 20 years now, can you imagine me working in a government office? I remember once I went to this one job. What was that job? I can't remember what it was now. But what did he say? Like, he said something like, yeah, we're really lucky that our employer is here. Our employer gives us an hour and a half for lunch. And they were like so happy with that. I'm thinking like, wow, really? Like, whoop-de-doo. Can't you just take lunch whenever you want? Like, it's just so, it's such a strange concept to me to have such a structured workday like that. So anyways, there wasn't a lot of work opportunities for me in Victoria. And actually, the other thing that really surprised me about living back in Canada was how expensive it was. Holy crap, was Canada ever expensive. People were shocked when I told them that Tokyo is actually cheaper to live in than Victoria is. This is something that really surprised me quite a bit as well. And also, too, is like the whole North American lifestyle of having a car. I kind of forgot how expensive that is because you buy a car, you have to buy insurance, you have to buy gas, you have to buy maintenance, you have to pay for parking. Like all this stuff adds up to be quite a bit. And in North America, a lot of these cities, you need a car. Like you can't rely on public transportation because it's no good. And everything is so spread out that you actually need a car. So it's not like Tokyo where you don't need a car. You can just hop on a train, you get everywhere. I was surprised that how much money I was spending just on getting around just with my car. So that really kind of surprised me. Originally, my plan was to go back there and buy a house, but nope, that's not going to happen. Unfortunately, Vancouver and Victoria now as well, and all the whole lower mainland area is one of the most expensive real estate markets in all of North America. all thanks to all these Chinese buyers who are trying to get their money out of China, and they're dumping it into the real estate market in Canada. So the housing prices have gone through the roof now. So the average selling price of like a 20, 30-year-old rundown piece of junk house is like over $1 million now. So it's just, it's really, really challenging to get into that market at all. So, which has obviously caused like the rental prices to go through the roof as well. So I was a little bit shocked at kind of all of that kind of surprised me. I wasn't thinking about moving back to Japan at that point, but I was kind of enjoying, I was enjoying being able to go mountain biking. I was enjoying all the nature and all of that while trying to figure out a better strategy for work and settling down. So that's what was happening in Canada. And I was still taking on some freelance work from actually clients here in Japan. When I had this one client who contacted me and see if I was interested in coming back to Japan and starting a travel business with him. And so I thought, well, you know, I don't mind that. The work opportunities in Victoria were pretty slim, even though I would have to give up a lot of the hobbies and extracurricular activities I was doing. I thought, well, you know, travel is booming in Japan. The Olympics are coming. I think I have some good ideas to bring something unique to the market. So yeah, I don't mind going back. I think it'd be a good opportunity to make a lot of money in a short period of time and then hopefully buy an overpriced tiny condo in Vancouver. So I came back to Japan. We got ready. We started getting to work. We started building the website and partnering up with businesses. And all of that was going great until someone in China ate bat soup, sneezed on their neighbor, and now the whole world has gone to hell. Yeah, you can imagine what happened. Pretty much tourism in Japan is completely dead now. And starting a tourism business right now is obviously not great. Both myself and the co-founder, we feel like the fundamentals of the business is sound. So when tourism does come back, we think that the business will do well. We're just not sure if we're going to be able to make it until tourism comes back, because obviously we have no idea when tourism is going to come back. So that's kind of in the nutshell of why I ended up back in Japan. My original goal was to come back and you know, take advantage of this big tourism boom. And the funny thing is initially when the virus situation started going crazy, I was looking at either country as to which one I thought would be safer to kind of wait this out in. And initially, Japan was looking safer because the numbers in Japan were quite low, while Canada hasn't closed its border yet, and Vancouver has a huge Chinese population. So there's like tons of Chinese going back and forth between China and Vancouver every day. So the virus count cases in Vancouver was just absolutely exploding. So I thought, well, it's probably safer to be in Japan now because the number of cases were low. But it turns out that the number of cases were low because the Japanese government wasn't testing anybody, because they were still hoping that they would be able to have the Olympics. So they were downplaying the severity of the cases in Japan because they were trying to promote the Olympics. Then finally, when they realized like that's not going to happen and they postponed the Olympics, boom, you saw like the cases suddenly explode here in Tokyo. I actually looked this up the other day. It's like in the last month in March, same day or beginning of March, there's like about 300 cases. And now today there's almost 4,000 cases. So 1 month, it's gone from like 300 to 4,000. And so I was like, whoa, okay, maybe I'll go back to Canada because Canada's looking a whole lot better. Problem is, Canada shut the border and Japan has now said that if you're a foreigner and you leave Japan, you're not allowed back in. So if I leave Japan and somehow miraculously everything gets better, I'm not sure when I could actually come back. So my partner doesn't want me to do that. So I'm kind of in limbo right now. gonna stay in Japan for now to see what happens. I feel fairly safe in terms of catching the virus because I primarily work from home and I only go out to get groceries. So in that regard, I'm not too worried about it. I'm not taking the train every day. I'm not around a lot of Japanese people. I kind of live outside of Tokyo a bit. So I'm kind of, hopefully I am okay in that regard. The idea of flying back to Canada does kind of scare me because I don't want to get on an airplane and travel and all that. That kind of scares me. So I'm hoping that maybe I might go back like later when things kind of settle down, if I can stay in Japan that long. But it's a big question mark right now as to what's going to happen. And I think this is the case for a lot of people, isn't it? Like, it's so interesting to see how quickly the whole world has shut down. Like, doesn't it seem like this situation has been going on a long time? But the reality is, just like literally 2-3 months ago, back in January, it was like, it wasn't a huge deal, right? You know, the WHO was saying, yeah, no problem, China has it all under control. Now we know that was all crap. But it just seems like it seems like it's been going on a long time, but the reality is it's actually been very short, and we might be facing a long period of this kind of like social distancing and self-isolation. So I think we're all going to have to try to kind of readjust our lifestyle. This, I saw the study the other day that said like this could be our new norm until like 2022 or even longer, because they don't know when they'll be able to get a vaccine, how effective the vaccine will be. Another virus could come out of China. So it's a rather interesting situation that's going on right now. It's kind of funny too, is I remember like a lot of people were comparing this to like the Spanish flu in 1918, I believe it was. And I remember like when I look at those photos, I can't help but feel like, oh, I wouldn't want to be around at that time during that, because their medicine probably is not that great. But really now, like, have we really progressed that much since 1918? Like, I think it's not hard to look at those people and think that they're a bit primitive. But the reality is, where are we now? Everyone's at home talking to each other over the internet, right? So it's kind of scary. It's kind of scary. And also, I think that it's made me kind of really appreciate how easy life has been for my generation and probably for a lot of others for a long period of time. Like, I was thinking about this like the other day, like probably I would guess that the last time the world was this involved together was probably World War II. I'm guessing, right? If I'm wrong, please tell me. But I'm guessing that the last time this kind of like global event that kind of brought everyone under the same umbrella, so to speak, was probably World War II. And ever since then, we've really taken our freedom and liberty for granted, haven't we? We've never thought about whether we can or cannot go outside. Like, for me, it never, ever, ever crossed my mind that we would be in a situation where we couldn't go outside. Like, that seems archaic. That seems like something that happened, you know, centuries ago when like the plague ran through Europe or something like that. Like, it doesn't seem like that would happen in our modern age. And yet here we are all stuck at home because some small tiny virus. So it's a wake-up call for our reality and the dangers of this kind of interconnected globalized economy, that one person in Wuhan can sneeze and suddenly the whole world is almost dead. So it's kind of scary. I hope this kind of forces countries to kind of rethink their global strategy, because, you know, I think like this super interconnected world where people can fly around the world just easily is obviously a big cause of this virus going everywhere. Like, if you look at the websites that chart the progress of this, it's really scary like how fast the virus has moved around the world. And that's all due to mainly air travel and just that with the ease at which people can travel around. So kind of an interesting situation. But so anyways, that's the update of why I'm back in Japan. And I figure since I'm stuck in my apartment for the next who knows how long, I thought I would fire up the old podcast again and start to interview some of the other people who are stuck in their homes here in Japan and find out what they're up to. So I hope some of you are still listening to the show. and if you are, thank you very much. And I look forward to speaking with you in the next episode. My name is Anthony Joe. Thanks for listening, everybody. And talk to you next time. Bye-bye.